Hello there. Today is Tuesday, October the 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as House committees interview more witnesses in the president's dealings with Ukraine to get dirt on Joe Biden, Trump's personal attorney could be in more legal trouble.
Rudy Giuliani has clearly been a leading force for the administration in defining a shadow foreign policy in Ukraine.
The situation in Syria is continuing to deteriorate and fast. Also ahead, clowns. They clown around with other clowns at a festival designed to throw a pie in the face of troubling times. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump announced sanctions Monday aimed at restraining the Turks' assault against Kurdish fighters and civilians in Syria. An assault Turkey began after Trump announced he was moving U.S. troops out of the way. The U.S. also called on Turkey to stop the invasion and declare a ceasefire. And Trump is sending Vice President Mike Pence and National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien to Ankara as soon as possible in an attempt to begin negotiations. The Americans were scrambling for Syria's exits, a move criticized at home and abroad as opening the door to a resurgence of the Islamic State group whose violent takeover of Syrian and Iraqi lands 5 years ago was the reason American forces came in the first place. The Turks began attacks in Syria last week against the Syrian Kurds, with reports of Turkish-backed fighters executing Kurdish fighters on the battlefield. Joining us to talk about the deteriorating situation is Dr. Amy Austin Holmes, a fellow with the Wilson Center's Middle East program and visiting scholar at Harvard's Middle East Initiative. Thank you for being with us. What can you say about all of that is happening?
It's an utterly chaotic situation because the president made this decision after a phone call with Erdogan without consulting his own team of national security advisors and without allowing the U.S. forces that are in Syria to withdraw. He basically gave a green light for Erdogan to begin this invasion with Turkish airstrikes and Turkish-backed rebels that are also on the ground. This began while U.S. forces were and are now still in Syria. And so what Trump has essentially done is not only put our allies, the Syrian Democratic Forces, in harm's way, he's also put American forces in harm's way. Originally, this was supposed to just be a limited withdrawal of some 50 U.S. troops from around Tal Abyad. That was what Trump originally had said. You know, we're only moving a few troops out of this little pocket around Tal Abyad, but otherwise the U.S. force structure will basically stay the same. But then the Turkish intervention went much farther than that, with airstrikes across multiple cities in northeastern Syria. And now Trump has had to decide to order a full withdrawal of U.S. troops. And so this has created chaos for the U.S., for the state. There were State Department personnel on the ground that were engaging in stabilization efforts in northeast Syria. It has also led to massive displacement of the civilian population. Over 100,000 civilians have already been displaced. The international NGOs, the humanitarian organizations that were working in northeastern Syria, many of them left the country because now the commander-in-chief of the Syrian Democratic Forces, Mazlum Abdi, you know, he has stated in an article that was actually published in Foreign Policy saying, if we're given the choice between genocide or compromise, we will choose our own people, meaning they face a situation where they either are going to be killed by Turkey or they have to strike a deal with the regime in Damascus and make a compromise. And that's what they've had to do now because of the sudden decision by Trump to withdraw from Syria. They felt, the Syrian Democratic Forces feel, that they are not able to because, I mean, they don't have an air force, right? They only have their ground forces, the SDF, and so they cannot defend themselves.
Do you think that Trump knew that soon after he made his announcement to give the green light to Turkey that this is what they planned on doing, that they planned on a full-on assault of the Kurds?
We will not know until the transcript of that conversation between Erdogan and Trump is made publicly available. We can only speculate as to what went on exactly, but it would be extremely naive of Trump to take Erdogan at his word and to think that this would be something, you know, limited. I mean, any of his national security advisors could have easily told him that this would be much more wide-scale intervention, and yet he simply actually, you know, didn't listen to them. He didn't listen to his own American security advisors.
He hasn't said anything as far as his concerns about the Kurds. He really hasn't commented other than saying that he's potentially going to put sanctions on Turkey, but the situation is so urgent that how would that make any difference?
Well, exactly. I mean, because, you know, he's now, I believe, announced that he's going to sanction Turkey, and there's bipartisan support in Congress for sanctioning Turkey. What we're also witnessing is really a fundamental shift, I think, in the U.S. relationship with Turkey, who's been our NATO ally since the early 1950s. I mean, there are even talks about removing the nukes from Incirlik Air Force Base in Turkey, because people have been saying, well, as long as we have nuclear weapons in Turkey, they could potentially become Erdogan's hostages, and so now there's talk about removing the nuclear weapons from Incirlik. You know, so this is really a phenomenal change in course of events that's happening, not just in Syria, but also with the U.S. relationship with Turkey. And ultimately, I think what, you know, what's happening is that the SDF is being forced to make an agreement with Damascus, which means that because Russia and Iran have both been supporting Damascus, that this will also, of course, you know, embolden and empower Russian and Iranian influence in Syria. And so the U.S., together with the SDF, we are the ones who defeated the Islamic State, right? But and who is going to reap the benefits of this victory? It's going to be Russia and Iran. I mean, so this is, you know, we're literally giving away our hard-fought victory over the Islamic State. And this one-third of Syria, the northeast of Syria, I mean, it's a territory approximately the size of West Virginia, or three times the size of Kuwait. Like, it's a pretty large chunk of territory that the SDF controlled. You know, that was the most stable region of Syria. That was the most well-functioning region of Syria, and all of that is jeopardized now because of this decision.
I would think it would be very difficult to start over with trying to defeat ISIS at this point.
Well, that's the concern, because we've seen also how some of the ISIS prisoners have already begun escaping. Erdogan claimed that he was going to take over in this fight against the Islamic State, and now, you know, the U.S. is withdrawing from Syria, so Turkey would finish the job with dealing with the remaining ISIS sleeper cells and even take care of the ISIS prisoners, etc. But why has Turkey then, you know, conducted airstrikes and shelling very close to the facilities where the ISIS prisoners are being detained? You know, that's going to lead to chaos and instability, which will only allow those ISIS fighters to escape. Susan Rice, you know, was speaking earlier today that essentially 10,000 ISIS prisoners have been given a get out of jail free card. They're just being allowed to potentially escape in the chaos and instability that has been caused by the sudden decision by Trump to withdraw from Syria. It's really a horrible situation.
That's Dr. Amy Austin Holmes, fellow at the Wilson Center's Middle East Program and visiting scholar at Harvard's Middle East Initiative. President Donald Trump's former top aide on Russia and Europe testified before closed doors at his impeachment inquiry Monday, possibly shedding light on Trump's May firing of Marie Yovanovitch, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Congressman Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland, says Fiona Hill, a former National Security Council expert on Russia, appeared before the House impeachment investigators and did well.
She was a remarkably thorough and authoritative witness who had truly amazing powers of recall of particular events and particular meetings.
Until July, when she left the White House, Hill was the senior director for European and Russian affairs on Trump's National Security Council, with knowledge of the behind-the-scenes formation of U.S. foreign policy. And last week, Yovanovitch, a career State Department diplomat, told lawmakers Trump dismissed her based on unfounded and false claims after Trump's personal attorney, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, assailed her performance in Ukraine. Joining us to discuss the latest developments in the impeachment inquiry and all of this is former Central Intelligence Agency officer and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, what's your take on what's been happening?
The fact that the president and the White House has simply said, we will not cooperate. We will not provide any individuals. We will not provide any documentation. It's an extraordinary stand to take in the first place, because they don't have a constitutional justification to do that. And in fact, if you take a look at what happened with Congress looking back at President Nixon, he tried to make a similar argument. And that was one of the reasons they used the justification for obstruction. And so I think that's one of the issues that the House Intelligence Committee is looking at right now, that obstruction piece. But if we take a look at what we're seeing in the last couple of days. We have Fiona Hill from the National Security Council. We also have former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Yovanovitch. They have both come out to talk about what was going on. And in the end, while we don't have everything out yet, what it appears that's already come before the House Intelligence Committee is this. The White House set up a shadow foreign policy that ran around the establishment to go directly to the Ukraine. And that's exactly what Fiona Hill was apparently talking about today. And that's extraordinary because, again, she was actually hired by President Trump.
Mm.
And she's the top administrator for Russia and Ukraine. The idea that the president has apparently used Rudy Giuliani to go around those individuals and go directly to people in Ukraine is extraordinary. And then you add the piece that Giuliani was doing it with two other officials, two Ukrainian officials, who apparently have now been charged, and they have been federally indicted with campaign finance violations. So there's a lot going on here, and there's a lot more to talk about.
The president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, we know now, is also under criminal investigation related to his business dealings in Ukraine. Of course, we know he was behind the scenes working to get the Ukrainian government to get dirt on former Vice President Joe Biden. Obviously, it's not good if your personal attorney is under criminal investigation, but do Democrats need that, really, for whatever information they're looking for within an impeachment inquiry, or is that a sidebar to all of this?
Actually, they don't. If we look at what the president actually said, again, we don't have a transcript. What we have is sort of an amalgamation of multiple sources that put together what it is that he actually said to the Ukrainian President Zelensky. That in itself is sufficient because there is a simple standard maxim that takes place in this case. No sitting president should ever pick up a phone, call a foreign leader and say, do me a favor, go after my political adversary. That in itself is crossing the line. That's the Rubicon that nobody should ever go beyond. But this president did exactly that. I think the purpose here of this investigation is to fill in those gaps, to make a determination, to prove that, in fact, the reason that he was doing this was because specifically, it wasn't about foreign policy. It wasn't about benefiting the United States. It was about benefiting Donald Trump personally. And what that does is provide an additional strength. And I think from a political standpoint, it drives Republicans to find a very difficult place to stand and say that that's okay.
What about some of the president's other staffers, like we're hearing now a former top aide to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been asked to appear Wednesday. Michael McKinley, a career Foreign Service officer, he was the de facto chief of staff, resigned Friday. The White House, I would imagine, cannot stop him from testifying now because he's not a member of the staff anymore?
Well, they could limit what it was that he said if it comes down to certain conversations where there's some privilege involved, but they may not be able to stop him. I think what we're seeing right now is a question of sort of how people see this is starting to unravel historically. I really do. I think that what we're going to start seeing here is more and more people potentially not wanting to be on the wrong side of history. Hmm. And so what I think they're going to do is you're going to see more people willing to actually come forward to articulate what it is that they saw that happened. Because in the event that this starts to unfold and really spin out of control, and it feels like it's getting closer and closer to that sometimes daily inside the Beltway, that if that happens, they don't want to be one of those people who appear to be obstructing alongside the president. So I think you're going to see more and more people willing to testify as to what they actually perceive. If there's some privilege, they'll acknowledge that. But I do think they're going to come forward more and more in the future, maybe even near future.
What about more whistleblowers? Do you think they'll come forward?
Yes, actually, I do. Because one of the reasons is that whistleblowers pay a price. And that's the fact that I think people need to acknowledge in general. Nobody benefits from being a whistleblower. They pay a very, very brutal price, sometimes professionally. We've seen this in many, many different ways. However, at the same time, when you start seeing more and more and more whistleblowers come forward, what it does is it encourages more people to come forward because they see that the cost will not be as high as if they were the only one.
All right, former intelligence agency officer and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Meanwhile, one witness who may not be called to testify before Congress in the impeachment investigation is still the anonymous whistleblower who touched off the inquiry. AP correspondent Rita Foley has that report.
Lawmakers have grown deeply concerned about protecting the whistleblower. Congressman Adam Schiff, the Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, says we don't need the whistleblower. He says they have the evidence they need about the phone call between President Trump and Ukraine's president, in which Mr. Trump asks Ukraine to investigate rival Joe Biden's family. President Trump tweeted an angry response, saying he needs to know the whistleblower's identity to, quote, determine why this was done to the USA. Rita Foley, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Three people have won the Economics Nobel Prize for work on global poverty. Vladimir Putin makes his first visit to Saudi Arabia since 2007. A Texas policeman has been charged with murder after shooting a black woman in her own home. And former Boko Haram fighters are seeking mental health care and forgiveness. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A dozen Democratic presidential candidates will be on stage for the party's primary debate Tuesday, later tonight, actually, in Westerville, Ohio. The impeachment inquiry involving President Donald Trump is likely to be a major topic of discussion, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Front and center on the debate stage Tuesday will be the current Democratic frontrunner, Joe Biden, whose lead in the polls recently has been slipping. Biden told supporters he now favors impeaching President Trump.
He's already convicted himself, in full view of the world and the American people. Donald Trump has violated his oath of office, betrayed this nation, and committed impeachable acts.
Biden has now joined the rest of the Democratic field in calling for Trump's impeachment, including his closest rival, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
What he has done has committed impeachable offenses, and he should be impeached.
Warren continues to build support, and recent surveys show her effectively tied with Biden atop the Democratic field, according to the Real Clear Politics average of polls. Tuesday's debate will also feature the return to the campaign trail of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who is recovering from a recent heart attack and who reached out to supporters through a campaign video.
And I also want to say that I am feeling great. I'm getting my endurance back, and I look forward to getting out on the campaign trail as soon as possible.
Much of Tuesday's debate is likely to focus on President Trump, says analyst John Fortier.
I think impeachment is going to be front and center. The candidates are all, I think, going to be very strong on the fact that they're for impeachment. I don't think there's going to be much daylight between them.
Those Democrats running behind the front runners also see this next debate as an opportunity, including California Senator Kamala Harris. Harris is also focused on President Trump.
He's getting Americans to turn on each other, and we need to heal. And I know I am uniquely able to bring our country together.
This will be the fourth Democratic candidates debate, and several of the contenders have already qualified for the next debate in November. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, for many Americans, the annual Columbus Day holiday on Monday honored the heritage and contributions of the 17 million plus Italian Americans living in the United States. But the Italian navigator namesake who set foot in the Americas in 1492, Christopher Columbus, has long been considered by many others as an affront to Native Americans who were there long before he sailed to the so-called New World. On a mission to correct history and honor the resilience of America's indigenous peoples, a growing movement to change the holiday is picking up steam across large swaths of the country. VOA's Ramon Taylor and Julie Tabot have this report.
For the 75th year, New Yorkers celebrated the world's largest display of Italian-American pageantry along Manhattan's Fifth Avenue. To organizers of the annual Columbus Day Parade, Christopher Columbus remains worth celebrating.
To me, Columbus will always be Columbus Day, and Any of those people in those days, we have to remember the good that they did. Let's forget about all the other controversy.
It's a suggestion that has long divided Americans. Honor tradition, or correct history and rectify the past.
The Europeans essentially tried to eradicate us. They brought disease. They banished us to reservations. Later on, when the U.S. government became an active force.
One of the first two Native American women elected to the U.S. Congress and a member of the Laguna Pueblo, Deb Haaland recently co-sponsored a national resolution to designate the second Monday in October Indigenous Peoples Day.
There's 573 distinct tribes right now in our country, and we're all diverse. And I think that it's an excellent way for us to celebrate the diversity and recognize that when other Indigenous people come to this country, that there's a place for them also.
Haaland and a growing number of Americans are speaking out about what they call a misnomer in Columbus Day. America, she says, was never discoverable in the first place, a concept that runs in direct contradiction to decades-old American history textbooks and the people who defend Columbus's legacy.
In their minds, in accepting the truth, is somehow shifting the power. That it contributes to the loss of power by minority over the majority. And I think that these attitudes and behaviors are so deeply entrenched that it is really based upon fear of losing a narrative, as false as that narrative is.
For the first time in state history, New Mexico officially replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day in 2019, joining a growing list of several states and more than 130 cities that have legally renamed the holiday. Festival attendees in the state's capital, Santa Fe, say it marks progress.
The truth is the truth. And so with Indigenous Peoples Day, it's a step in that right direction.
While others at New York's Columbus Day Parade say it shouldn't be an either-or decision.
Those who want to honor Columbus, then they keep that day. But those who want to honor the ones who lived before us, like the Indigenous people of America, if they want to honor them, that's okay too.
Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, things are tough all over with many worrisome stories in the news these days, but some red-nosed, pie-tossing lovers of fun say let's find some joy. VOA's Arash Arabasadi tells us what it's all about.
In the city of smiles hangs a red nose, the universal symbol of comedy. Something funny is afoot.
I think people are coming to realize that the spirit of a clown, the essence of a clown, is from the inside.
The 2019 Clown and Clown Festival brought a lot of red noses and jokers from around the world to the eastern Italian town of Monte San Giusto. More than a laugh-a-minute party, clowns celebrating laughter say laughing is itself a celebration. And at a time, they say, the world could use much more.
Laughter sounds the same, whatever your religion might be, no matter what place in the world you're from. Laughter unites the world.
Laughter is contagious. You look at a baby laughing and it rubs off, or someone laughs and we laugh about that, right? It's a wonderful thing of humanity. It is the most human thing that exists, laughter, crying.
Today in life, there's a lot of kids like you who have lost their homes, their country, and they are all over the world dispersed.
Sometimes even the best clowns play to crowds in difficult times on less than ideal stages.
I'm a humanitarian clown, so I go to places of war, conflict, and disadvantaged communities. I work with people as a clown and let them find their own clown as well. This is the least I could do for humanity right now. Laughter is one of the human rights and is as important as food and shelter.
Performers say finding the joy in life is at the core of the clown.
I think that's the essence of clown, and that's what the clown reminds people of. We all have that joy and that celebration, but sometimes we bury it for a variety of reasons. And the clown reminds us to have it, to have that joy and that sense of freedom and celebration.
About 20,000 visitors watched 46 artists perform at this, the week-long 15th Clown and Clown Festival. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
A busy weekend at the box office, and we have a review now from a movie expert. Jeffrey K. Howard, Vegas film critic here with us. Talk about the latest Will Smith action film, Gemini Man. Jeff, what do you think?
Yes. Oh, well, this is from one of my favorite directors, Ang Lee, who gives us some of the serious dramas and also some of the cinema's best action films. I mean, take movies like Mission Impossible. Also, he did Face Off, you know, with Nicolas Cage, which is a classic action film. And then he does incredible dramas like The Life of Pi, which is one of my favorite films. And now he's got Will Smith along this time for playing Gemini Man. And Will Smith plays an assassin. And after 25, 30 years, he wants to retire after like 75 kills. But he's being hunted on the last days of his career. And it's by a younger, faster man who knows absolutely every move he's making before he does. And he finds out that it's a clone of himself. So we're in a really interesting situation where Will Smith not only plays himself in his 50s, but also himself when he was in his early 20s, like when he was in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So the special effects are amazing because he fights himself, he talks to himself, and Ang Lee told him, look, I need you to act less when you're playing your younger self because, you know, he's such a seasoned actor now. He has to go back to his early days and kind of act less. And not only are you going to get an amazing special effects action film, but Ang Lee really stages like motorcycle chases and hand-to-hand combat. And you think, well, we've seen that before in cinema, but Ang Lee really brings it an originality to it. And I think it's just fascinating because this is a $140 million epic. And every time Will Smith is playing his younger self and his real self, it's like $100,000 a minute. So this is not only a cutting-edge technology, but they're actually making him look younger. So there's all kinds of controversies, like, should you be doing that with actors? Should you be aging them, you know, making them look younger for the big screen? We're going to see the same treatment coming up next month from Martin Scorsese for the Netflix film The Irishman, where they're going to de-age Robert De Niro and also Joe Pesci. So there's all different stages of his life. You're going to see De Niro go from a young man to what he looks like today. So not only is it a fascinating action film, but I just think Gemini Man is a real, real exciting action piece. I'm a Will Smith fan, so if you are, I think you're going to really enjoy this action film.
Okay, Jeff, and I know we've got another one on Netflix, the Eddie Murphy film Dolomite.
Dolomite Is My Name is from Netflix, and what's really fun about this is Eddie Murphy's return. I hate the word comeback, but this is his return to the big screen. And what's really fascinating about Eddie Murphy is he takes on this whole persona of Rudy Ray Moore, and he is based on the real character, the real man who plays Dolomite. And back in the early 70s, he was doing these kind of nerdy nursery rhymes that were all over these underground clubs, and he made an album of it. So he plays this persona of Dolomite, and then he made a feature film. He wanted to be on the big screen. And so he put every penny together. He scraped all his friends together. He paid, you know, he just did this incredible, ridiculous film that was a huge hit. So this is a frozen in time, a throwback to the 1970s with Eddie Murphy and also some of the most talented black actors and comedians. This is something that is garnishing all kinds of attention and also Oscar buzz, believe it or not. So it's streaming now on Netflix, but it's also playing in limited release in theaters in your town.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, his full video reviews can be found at VegasFilmCritic.com.
pop star who had long been the target of abusive online comments has died. Sully, a former member of the top girl group FX, was found dead in her home earlier today. According to authorities, she was found by her manager. The 25-year-old had reportedly been suffering from severe depression. She suspended her career in 2014 after struggling with the impact of cyberbullying and other issues. The exact cause of her death is under investigation.
Thanks for joining us on International Edition today. That does it for our show. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Yeah.